Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour. Sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour, an editorial review, is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and editorial review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on hyperinflation when we come back. Well, 3,000 years ago, before the science of meteorology was even thought of, King Solomon, old King Solomon, wrote in Ecclesiastes 1, verse 7, that all of the rivers run into the sea, and yet the sea is not full. Unto the place from whence the rivers come, thither they return again. Well, every year, the continents and islands of this earth pour down into the oceans a stupendous volume of water. It's about 286,000 cubic miles of water flow into the oceans every year. Well, for century after century and millennium after millennium, this has been going on, and the sea hasn't increased its level by so much as an inch. Now, how is that possible? Well, we call it the cycle of evaporation and precipitation, and the writer of Ecclesiastes said that the ocean maintains its level in spite of this gigantic annual influx. And that's because the rivers go back to the place from whence they came, and indeed they do. Every drop of rain that falls climbs back upon the Creator's elevator of evaporation to form themselves into clouds and then ride back to the head of their toboggan slide to begin their journey all over again. Now, in the modern science of meteorology, we understand this, and we understand the laws. Modern science has now learned what the writer of Ecclesiastes knew 3,000 years ago. Now, this is just one more of the many examples of science in the Scripture, and it's one more of the many lessons in my Mosaic Law School conducted twice a year here at the Law School in Isabella, Missouri. If you'd like more information, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package? That's the place to start. It's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free. And you can call and order yours right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Once more, a little slower, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and then send us an email request for your free general law CD package. Again, georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about hyperinflation. We've been experiencing ordinary inflation since about 1914, when we created the United States Federal Reserve System. We introduced an inflationary system, a system whereby we knew we were going to have inflation. That's the purpose for having a central bank, so that you can have inflation and growth. It's a progressive, it's a liberal ideology. And the banks in the countries of Europe had had it for centuries. The Bank of England, for instance, was inaugurated back in 1691. And so from 1690 or so up through 1900, the English had a central bank. The French and the Germans had central banks. And for some reason, we Americans adopted the concept that if it was such a good idea over there, that probably it would be a good idea over here. Our founding fathers in 1787 knew about the Bank of England, but they did not adopt a central banking system or policy over here in the colonies or in the new country, the United States of America. Could it be that they knew something or believed in a different philosophy than the central banking idea or ideology? Well, we entered into a period of inflation through World War I, which culminated in the Great Depression in 1929. And we opted in 1929 for deflation, which was a bitter pill to swallow from 1929 to 1940. A bitter pill to swallow. But I would submit to you that deflation pill is a sweeter pill than the hyperinflation pill that we're about to swallow. Well, you know, back in the 1920s, we had a boom period like the 1990s. And God, everybody loved it. Everybody was making money, and everybody was drinking hooch, going to speakeasies. The ladies were raising their hemlines and cutting their hair shorter and smoking cigarettes, and it was a party. Kind of like the 1990s, you know, it was a big party, and everybody had a great time. And then when the Depression came, then that's the hangover time. That's the sobering up period. It wasn't very pleasant, but we got through that. And then we went into World War II, and we had pretty good value in our money. It was inflated from 1933 to 1945, but, you know, we still had pretty good money. And then after World War II, and the Marshall Plan and the rebuilding of Europe, we went into the 1950s and the Cold War, and that Cold War was a drain on us. And about 1971, we couldn't pay our bills anymore. We needed another devaluation is what we needed. You know, our gold coin was $20.67 in 1930, and then we devalued it to $35. And then we got up to 1971, and we couldn't pay our bills at $35 an ounce for gold, so we went off this gold standard, and gold went up until in 1979, just from 71 to 79 or 80, the price of gold went up to $850 an ounce. Kind of went up a little bit on the high side, and then it dropped back down. And then through the 1980s and 90s, the gold finally leveled off at around $300 an ounce, and now it's doubled again to about $600. But you can see that today in 2006, the price of gold at $600 an ounce versus the price of gold in 1933 at $35 an ounce, you can see that there's been some inflation here. Let's just take that at $625 the other day and divide that by 35. And, you know, that's 18 times. 18 times. So if you take a look at the value of the dollar in 1930, and then you trace that dollar up to today in 2006, it has a little bit less than 3 cents worth of purchasing power left. So when we talk about the collapse of the dollar, we're not talking about something that's going to happen in the future. Boys and girls, you lived right through it. It's already happened. It's a done deal. And what we're talking about today is the collapse of the last 3 cents. That's all we're concerned about is the last 3 cents. So if you have a bunch of these 3 cent dollars and you want to save as much of the purchasing power as you possibly can, which I think is the logical thing to do before the hyperinflation sets in and wipes out all of its value, like it has so many times in the past and in a number of other countries, then you need to take some positive action today. And one of the things that we do is to get rid of the fiat currency. We get rid of dollars and marks and the scudos and rubles, and we buy gold and silver or wheat, corn, beans, honey and oil or toilet paper. We convert it into substance. We pay off the mortgage on our house. We sell the SUV that's got the big mortgage payments on it and trade it in, and we buy an old Ford station wagon that we own free and clear. We get ourselves unencumbered so that we can hang on to the toys that we have. And actually, the best position to get into, if you've got a few extra shekels that you can rub together, is to get into a cash position so that when the hyperinflation takes over, you move from the cash position back into commodities like houses. For instance, to give you an illustration, in 1980, or 89, I guess about, we had a housing boom and collapse. And housing prices lost about 40% of their value. All right, so let's take a $100,000 house that loses 40% of its value. You come back into the market and buy the house for $60,000. Now, many of those houses will lose half their value. So let's take a $100,000 house that you're in today and you own it free and clear. You sell it and convert it to gold, bury it in a hole in the ground. And when the market goes back to $50,000, you take the same $100,000 and trade it in, buy two houses. You've doubled your money. Now, that's the way we do that, fairly simple. Now, that's just a few people that are going to do that. Most people hang on to their houses, making payments on them until they lose their job. And then when the housing values go from $100,000 to $50,000, they lose their house. Somebody else comes along and buys their house, and the $50,000 equity that they've got, and they just get wiped out, and they've lost it. Now, that's where most people end up. Now, has this ever happened before? Oh, my God, it's happened many, many times. It happened in Hungary, Germany, Argentina, Brazil, Uruguay, Paraguay, Hungary, China, the United States, Ecuador, and Peru. Now, that's the list that I've got here in the literature in front of me. There are many other countries and many other historical examples of hyperinflation, wiping out economies and wiping out societies and civilizations and promulgating wars and famines and death and destruction. You know, the hyperinflation of it by itself doesn't kill you, but the famine and the economic dislocation that comes from it kills millions. So the economic systems of the world have killed millions and millions and millions of people, just like disease has. We don't blame it on hyperinflation or upon economies. We blame it upon famine. But the famines are triggered by the collapse of the economy brought on by the inflation or the wars that come either before or after and kill millions of people like World War I and World War II. Now, World War II was the direct result of the hyperinflation in Germany in 1923. Direct result. And that killed 50 million people. And although there wasn't much of a famine after World War II, there certainly was a lot of death and destruction during the war itself. Now, in 1982 or 3, when President Reagan took over the White House, he commissioned a group of people called the Grace Commission to take a look at the economy of the United States and to make recommendations, because the 21% interest rates that Paul Volcker invoked in 1978, 79, and 80 was the direct result of President Nixon taking us off of the gold standard in 1971. Now, Nixon did what he had to do because from 1944 with the Bretton Woods Agreement until 1971, in conjunction with fiat currency, that is paper money issued by the Federal Reserve, we got to a point where we couldn't pay our bills anymore. And there was a run on the bank, so President Nixon closed the gold window. As a result of closing the gold window, we had a couple of years later, if you'll remember, the oil crisis of 1973. And that led, you know, into a couple of others of these oil crises and a balance of payments crises and economic dislocations. And we had this tremendous inflation through the 1970s, culminating in a real bitter pill called 21% interest in 1979 and 80. Most of us thought this is the end of the game, game is over, but Paul Volcker pulled the fat out of the fire. And President Reagan, wanting to control the economy, commissioned the Grace Commission and said, okay, what do we have to do to get back on track? And the Grace Commission put out a report, and a fellow by the name of Harry Figger, Figge, F-I-G-G-I-E, made a series of speeches, and this speech is condensed from a series of lectures presented by Harry E. Figge Jr. at the Town Hall of Los Angeles, California, June 27, 1988. And then the City Club of Cleveland, Ohio, March 31, 1989. And then the League of Women's Voters or Woman Voters in Cleveland, Ohio, July 26, 1990. And it has to do with America's economy and hyperinflation. And Harry Figge begins by saying, I want to thank you for the opportunity to address you today on the subject of the national debt. And I want to stress first and foremost that I am a businessman, and I have never been and never intend to be involved in politics. However, if you wonder why I'm up here, I really love my country, because as I tell people, where else but in the United States could a person from humble means, whose father died when he was 16, follow his life plan and build two companies? I'm here today because I fully believe that this great country of ours is heading into serious trouble, and because of our government's dangerous inability to reduce its debt or control ongoing budget deficits. I became involved in this issue by accident in 1982 when Peter Grace made me co-chairman of the President's Private Sector Survey on Cost Control, also known as the Grace Commission. And as a result of that, I became privy to some information I wished I'd never heard about, information that showed me how threatening our government spending policies are. This past Tuesday, I met with several congressmen on the subject, including Congressman Dennis Eckert from Cleveland and Congressman Dick Armey from Texas. And I showed six different congressmen the debt and deficit projections over the next few years, and every one of them said, gee, I didn't know it was that bad. I didn't realize where we were headed. They had no idea that the ball game is going to be over in 1995. Dick was an economics professor and is probably the most knowledgeable man in Congress on economics. But after I showed him the projections, Dick said, Harry, you just ruined my day. And I said, well, it's about time. Peter ruined mine in 1982, and I haven't had a good day since. Now, surveys today show that the national debt and the deficit are uppermost in the minds of the American people. And Congress recognizes this, and they say that it was the savings and loan crisis that finally brought it home to the American people. But I say it was perfectly understandable all along, because the Americans have been struggling personally with debts and deficits and budgets all of their lives, and they know what happens to them if they do not live within their personal income. So naturally, they begin to worry when they see a profitable country that is not living within its income and hasn't lived within its income since 1952. Now, I want to put this massive problem into the context of the person on the street and show you why the government is headed into real trouble. Now, let's say that you have a net take-home pay of $1,000, and you take $100 of that $1,000, and you put it into some kind of a pension plan, like a Kroger or an IRA or a 401k. And the other $900 just barely makes ends meet. You just barely make your payments. So now suppose somebody gives you free credit cards, and they give you American Express, Visa, MasterCard, Discover, whatever you want. But you realize that you cannot use these credit cards. And that's because you don't have an income large enough to service the debt if you were to use these cards and run up a debt. So then all of a sudden you meet a very tall man with a long white beard and a big stovepipe hat and red and white striped pants and a blue coat with stars all over it. And he says, my name is Sam, Uncle Sam. And I am a financial advisor, and I want to be your financial advisor, and I want you to follow my advice. I want you to use your credit cards. And when they bill you, you just send them a 30-year IOU at 8% interest. And you say, yeah, but I have to pay the interest, even if they accept my IOUs. And your new financial advisor, Uncle Sam, says, well, do you remember that $100 that you were putting in a pension plan? Okay, you take that $100, and then you use that to pay the interest, and then put an IOU in your pension plan. 20 years from now, you'll have 20 years worth of IOUs in your pension plan, but what do you care? And you remind him, Uncle Sam, that there's a difference between you and me. You've got a printing press in your basement which gives you unlimited credit, but I'm going to go to jail if I do that. And that's why Americans are concerned, because they know that we can't keep on doing this forever. Well, before I go any further, let me explain the difference between deficit and debt. for those of you that might not be familiar with these economic terms. Term number one is deficit. The deficit is the shortfall that we have in any one year. So if you take in $100 billion and you spend $110 billion, you have a deficit of $10 billion. So at the end of that year, you've got to do something with that $10 billion that you owe. So you move it over into your long-term shortfall, and that becomes your debt. Well, in 1982, the annual deficit was $128 billion, which was up from $4 billion in 1974. Now, the debt in 1982 was at $1 trillion. That was up from $484 billion in 1974. But it had taken us 200 years from the start of our republic until 1974 to create that debt of $484 billion. And we had gone through World War I and II, the Korean and Vietnam Wars, and we still had a very manageable situation as recently as 1974. Now, since 1982, when the debt first hit $1 trillion, it has tripled now until it is $3 trillion. Now, when Peter Grace called me and a number of others down to Washington in 1982, we were commissioned by President Reagan to find some savings in our government. And I can tell you that that savings, finding savings in the government spending program, was like shooting fish in a rain barrel. We contributed $77 million of corporate money and about 500 employees, and we found $424 billion in savings in 9 months. 9 months, $424 billion. That was enough savings in the spending program of our government to have paid off the entire national debt in 1974. And we found it in 9 months with 500 employees and $70 million of private money. Then it goes a little further than that. We could easily have identified more than $1 trillion in savings, but Reagan wasn't interested in going any further. In fact, when we showed him the $424 billion in savings, he stopped us right there. He stopped us cold in our tracks. Reagan was not interested in going any further. Of the $424 billion that we identified, Congress instituted $152 billion in savings by 1986. Now, if that had been spread annually, that averages $38 billion in savings a year. And at the same time, President Reagan pushed through a $50 billion tax increase. Now, you take the $50 billion of new revenue from the tax increase and the $38 billion in spending that we saved, and that's $88 billion. And that should have gone to reduce the deficit, which at that time was $128 billion. So we should have dropped the annual deficit to $40 billion instead of $128. But instead of that, the government says we ran a $152 billion deficit last year, up from $128 billion to $152 billion. Now, the problem is, in the past 10 years, government revenue has gone up by 8% a year, compounded. But expenditures have gone up 11% a year, compounded. Now, that doesn't sound like very much, but let me put it into perspective for you. Right now, Congress has 116% more money to spend than they had 10 years ago, but they've spent 186% more money than they've taken in from 10 years ago. So every time you give Congress $1, they're spending $1.58. And I'll tell you what I learned in Washington. They not only don't understand this problem, they don't even care about it. So the thing that finally brought me up short and has ruined my last 8 years were the projections that Peter got from his economists. And these numbers I'm going to give you, and I've had verified in the last 6 months by the Citizens Against Government Waste, so they're very current. We are at $1 trillion in debt as of 1982, and that debt is going to go to $13 trillion in the year 2000. And we're at an annual deficit of $128 billion, and the deficit is going to go to $2 trillion. Now, let me graph the debt on my thumb and forefinger. I've got my thumb horizontal and my finger vertical. Now, you've got 1776 way out here at the tip of my thumb, and the debt line runs along my thumb absolutely flat until 1976. It gets up into the web of my thumb in about 1980, and it starts to come up about 1995. We're at the first knuckle of my finger. Now you turn asymptotic. You start going straight up, and by the year 2000, you're straight up to the top. Now, what does that mean? Well, that means that when we hit the $500 billion deficit here in 1995, on our way to the $2 trillion deficit in 2000, we have lost our ability to control our economy by taxation, and we run the risk of something that I'm going to talk about called hyperinflation. Hyperinflation. Now, back in 1982, I said, well, we've got some time, and nobody's going to be this stupid. We are going to get people to understand this thing. Now, today, I'm very sorry to have to report to you that as I stand here in 1990, We're somewhere between 1990 and 1993 in our deficit projections, a little bit ahead of target. And I was with Senator Robert Dole the other day, and he'd just come from the White House budget negotiations, and he said, "We didn't make any progress again today, but we will. We will," he said. Now, you've all heard about the Graham-Rudman Act. It used to be Graham, Rudman, and Hollings, but Senator Hollings said he wanted a divorce from the bill because it was such a travesty. So Graham Rudman originally said that we would have a zero deficit in 1991, but revised that to a $60 to $65 billion deficit 2 years later. Now, the reason that Congress runs around like chickens with their heads cut off right now is technically, unless they get a budget agreement, they've got to cut $100 billion out of the budget this year because they're at $168 billion. And the thing I want to tell you is that the $168 billion that you hear is a travesty, it's a lie. And it's a lie that's been foisted off on the American people. Now, do you remember all those IOUs that you were peeling out of your pension fund and your credit card fees? Well, government doesn't even count those as a part of the cash deficit. They use a plan or a process called hedonic accounting. And we have for 6 years run an actual deficit in the U.S. government of over $250 billion, and this year we're running between $360 and $435 billion. But that's not what's being reported. So let me explain that to you. You start with Graham Rudman. That's $168 billion. Now remember the credit card example? When you took $100 billion or $100 away from the Kroger or the IRA and you sent them an IOU? Well, that's what the government is doing. The government is doing that to 9 trust accounts, including Social Security, military pensions, railroad pensions, and postal pensions. You see, the government is taking $120 billion in these trust fund surpluses and spending them, and replacing that spending with IOUs instead of funding them with cash. And they're funding them with a federal deficit. And they don't even count those IOUs or the interest on those IOUs. And when those IOUs start coming due, the government's going to owe trillions of dollars to Social Security, which will be supporting more retirees with fewer workers. So that's the first thing that's been foisted off on the American people. Now, the savings and loan crisis is another. Mossbacher, our country's head economist, made very sure when President Bush stuck his neck out on the savings and loan crisis that those costs were taken off the deficit. The current estimates are that the savings and loan crisis will cost us $500 billion overall and $100 billion next year. There's another $100 billion that's not even being counted. So the deficit has gone from $168 billion to $388 billion, and I haven't talked to you about the student loan problem, and I haven't mentioned to you about the $300 to $500 billion toxic waste cleanup that's going to come from our military bases, and we haven't added in or talked about the crack babies or the AIDS problem or any new programs that Congress is talking about implementing in the future. So we're running right now a true deficit of $300 to $500 billion a year. And our estimate is that at $500 billion, we lose our capacity to control the economy by taxation. Now, don't even think for a minute that Congress doesn't want inflation, because they know that inflation is the only way that they can pay off this debt. The way to pay off the debt is with inflated dollars. And if that isn't bad enough, the financial structure of the United States is now very tenuous. And so let me give you a few examples. All right, before we get into these examples of government spending and the tenuous problems that we face, now this is back in 1990, children, 1990, and these projections were based upon the Grace Commission's analysis from 1982 through 1990 in that 8-year period. And they said hyperinflation's coming, and the magic number now, remember this magic number, is a budget deficit of $500 billion a year. And the budget deficit has been in excess of $500 billion a year since 1990. But we've been hearing reports of balanced budgets under the Clinton administration through the 1990s, when in reality, the budget deficits were $500 billion. And that's because today, in the Social Security Trust Fund, just one of the funds, just Social Security, from 1983 to 2000, it was running a surplus of more than $100 billion a year. And they took the $100 billion, and they spent it, and they put an IOU in there. So Social Security doesn't have any money. It's got a lot of IOUs in there. And guess who the surety underwriters of the IOUs are? It's the taxpayers. Now, don't you think that that's preposterous accounting? To take out of your savings, to take out of your IRA, and then spend that for your daily living, putting IOUs into your pension fund, and then when it comes time for you to retire, there's no money in the pension fund, but we've got all these IOUs that are signed by and guaranteed by you. Now you're 65, you've retired, you don't have a job, you don't have any income, and you've got $1 million in your pension fund, and they're all IOUs that you owe. Now, don't you think that that's insane? Don't you think that that's preposterous? Well, if you think that's preposterous for you and your pension plan, don't you think that that's just as preposterous and just as insane for the government to do that with Social Security, railroad pensions, government pensions, and 9 pension funds? Isn't it? Have we taken leave of our senses, children? Now hang on and I'll be right back. As soon as I remind you that you're listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. And if you'd like more information about the law school and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives, and it can be accessed through our webpage at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that those authors or those publications that we endorse or recommend are going to reciprocate. And that's because most of these authors and publications that we cite on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not entirely endorsed by the Law Hour or editorial review. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or you can call the law school direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about the Figge Report, F-I-G-G-I-E, published back in 1988, 89, and 90. It's an outgrowth of the Grace Commission, commissioned by President Reagan in 1982, looking into hyperinflation. He goes on to say that we definitely have a recession on the horizon, and we're just beginning to see it, and we're seeing it in furniture and housing and all through construction and aerospace. Now, let's talk about our commercial banks, because since 1983, 713 commercial banks have failed. Now, that's only 5% of the commercial banks in the United States, but when you fail 5% of your banks in your good years, in good times, can you imagine what the bad times were going to do? The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation Chairman Bill Seidman came out the other day and he said, if we get a severe recession, the safety net that we have under the commercial banks will never hold. There isn't enough money in FDIC. Now, most people don't realize this, but 13 insurance companies failed in 1988. Now, I'm talking about property and casualty insurance companies, not the health insurance companies. 39 failed in 1989, so we've had 52 insurance companies fail in 2 years. Now, the other thing that you don't hear about is that the federal government is underwriting $5.8 trillion of debt from things that aren't truly government, such as deposit insurance, loan guarantees, pension programs, government-sponsored enterprises, direct loan programs, and the list goes on and on. So if we get a severe downturn in 1992, 93, 94, and after 50-some years of recovery, we've got to be sitting out there somewhere, and we're going to be, to steal the words of a man whose lips we all watched carefully, in deep, deep doo-doo. Now, what I find frightening is the rapid rate of deterioration. It's the old story that the light at the end of the tunnel is an oncoming train. And when we can go 200 years and create less than $500 trillion in debt, and then in a mere 16 years go from less than $500 trillion to $3 trillion in debt, we're really beginning to see things get bad, and they're getting bad very rapidly. So the question is, what's going to happen? What's the ultimate outcome of this? And one of the people that I respect most in government is Chuck Boucher, the former Arthur Anderson partner, who's Comptroller General of the United States. Charles was sent to New York City about 10 years ago to straighten it out financially, and he said that he and the governor, Governor Kerry, sat at a table day after day, and Kerry made real tough decisions until they got New York into the kind of fiscal condition where they could sell its bonds again. And so I took my hyperinflation scenario to Charles, and I said, Charles, tell me that I'm wrong. And he said, you're wrong. And I said, great. So what do you think is going to happen? And he said, we're going to have a financial panic, and we're going to get to the point where the central banks of the world, central banks like Japan and Germany, can see that the United States is not going to be able to service our debt, and they're going to quit buying our government paper. And I said, great. Now we're going to have a fiscal panic. We're not going to go to hyperinflation. Can you imagine a businessman standing around cheering for a financial panic or a deflation? But nothing happened. And after about 4 weeks, I started to wonder what those bonds were doing. Now, I think you know that at one point, Japan was buying 35% of our debt. But in about the last 6 to 8 weeks, the Japanese market broke. And I found that the Japanese have scaled back, but the Saudis came in and replaced them 100%. So now we're back to my scenario, which incidentally scares the hell out of me. Now, what our charts show is that in 1995, we're not going to be able to control our deficit and our debt by taxation. Now, we're going to move to what is called hyperinflation. And by that, I mean severe runaway inflation that leads to devaluation of the currency. In Brazil and Argentina, they have lopped 6 zeros off of their money in the last few years. And that meant that if you had $1 million at the first lop, you had 1,000. And at the second lop, you had a dollar. Now, I'll talk a little bit about that. During World War II, when I was fighting house to house in Germany, I found an old cigar box on the floor where a bunch of money had spilled out. So I picked it up and I looked at it. And it was Weimar Republic money from 1923. Totally worthless. Absolutely valueless. Well, I picked up about 8 or 10 of those bills and I put them in my pocket and I brought them home. Today they hang in my office. One of those bills especially frightens me because it is 100 million marks. In 1923, they were taking bushel baskets of those 100 million mark notes down to the store to try to buy potatoes and bread. And so that's a real reminder to me. To find out about hyperinflation, we looked at all of the countries in the world. The German-French experience with hyperinflation was too long ago. Israel is a microcosm. Russia is unknown. Yugoslavia was just getting started. They were up to about 2,000%. So then we looked at South America and we said, that's where it's at. So we picked Argentina, Brazil, and Bolivia as the best examples. Now, the problem that I run into when I talk to people about this hyperinflation, they say, oh, you studied the Banana Republic. And I have two parts to my answer. The first is, well, welcome to the United States Banana Republic. And the second answer that most people don't know is this, and that is, in 1938, the fifth largest economy in the world was the country of Argentina. It was very sophisticated, very well run, and very knowledgeable. They had an excellent agriculture, excellent manufacturing, and they had good natural resources. They are now the world's 78th largest economy. So if you think that it can't happen in the United States, you want to remember that it already happened in Argentina from 5th to 78th. It isn't hard to imagine going from 1st to 10th, 15th, or 20th. Now, for our study, we were very fortunate because we were able to meet with 80 top businessmen in those three countries. Businessmen from Bolivia, Brazil, and Argentina. And they weren't just businessmen either. They were government officials, bankers, and financial executives as well as being businessmen. Well, Dr. Jerry Swanson, who is an economist from the University of Arizona, led our team. And he took one of our group controllers and our director of purchasing. And they took 4 trips over a 2-year period. And the thing that happened is that all 80 of these businessmen said to us, what in the hell is wrong with the United States? You are exactly on the same course that we were on 20 to 30 years ago. You are 20 to 30 years behind us. They said, everything that we did wrong, you are doing wrong today. For example, you have huge deficits. You have a deterioration in your balance of payments. You have eroded the confidence in your currency. You have a tendency to blame outsiders and call for protectionism. And then finally, the exchange value of your currency is falling. And twice since the mid-1970s, you have devalued your currency, and there is pressure on you to devalue again. And they said all 5 factors are in place, and the United States is following the same path to hyperinflation that all of our countries followed 20 to 30 years ago. And what we can't understand is why you Yankees cannot see what is coming. Well, when Jerry came back from his last trip, I said, Jerry, give me a synopsis. And he said, well, for years, in my economics course at the University of Arizona, I have been teaching that deficits cause inflation. Then he said, they do. I just saw it in 3 countries. And I said, okay, tell me about hyperinflation. How much time do you have before hyperinflation sets in? And Jerry said, in Brazil, it set in 3 days. 3 days. Now, the terrible thing about hyperinflation is once the hyperinflation gets started, it's impossible to stop it. You see them trying to stop it now in Argentina, and you see them trying to stop it in Brazil. And Brazil is a perfect example. They put in wage and price controls, and then they seized 80% of the capital of the people. They did all of the right things, but 54% of the people worked for the government, and they turned around and gave them pay increases to keep pace with the inflation that they're creating, and they're reinflating right now. And during the time that we were studying this, Argentina's inflation hit 5,000%. Brazil's got to 5,000% in 3 days, and Bolivia got to 25,000% with bursts of up to 50,000% inflation. So let me tell you how bad that is. We've got a book here, and we published on how to survive hyperinflation if you're a businessman. And we have a picture of a guy with a huge bag going into a bank in Bolivia. And at the bank, they simply weighed the package, and they gave him a note of exchange. Now, the terrible truth about this thing is that nobody looked into the bag. They didn't even care whether he had newspaper in there, old socks, $1,000 bills, $10,000 bills, or dollar bills. They didn't care what it was. It was so worthless. That's what happens in hyperinflation. The money simply becomes worthless. So I say that this can't happen here, but that's wrong. And I hear the argument periodically that the reason that it won't happen to us is that our deficit is only 5% of our gross national product. Well, the Brazilian and Argentine deficits are only 8% of their gross national products. It's not a huge jump from 5 to 8%. So when these economists give you the garbage that our deficit is only a few percentage points of the GDP, it doesn't mean a thing. If inflation hit South American standards in 1 month, a cab out to the airport would go from $15 to $600 in 30 days. Now, our guys went into a supermarket in South America, and they watched a lady pick up a loaf of bread, only to have the price change before she got to the cash register. And the standard joke down here is, you take a cab, don't take a bus. In a cab, you don't have to pay until you get out, and by then the money is worth less. Right now, Yugoslavia has over 2,000% inflation. You have inflation in Israel. You don't read much about it, but you have a very severe inflation in Russia. There's inflation going on all around the world, and when you look behind it, it's due to the deficits that these governments are incurring. Now, for 8 years, I've been ready to beat my head against Congress, but it wasn't until we got to this so-called budget crisis that I could even get in to see these congressmen to make any sense to them. There was never a more important time than right now, and there's never been a more important issue than right now. It isn't a Democratic issue, and it isn't a Republican issue. It's an American issue, and we've got 5 years left, maybe 10, before we lose our capability to offset this problem through taxation, and even that would be about 100% taxation. Now, the voice of the people has got to be heard, and this is why I'm talking to the League of Women Voters. We need strong opposition to this deficit spending, and we need strong operations out in the field to go and sit down with these guys and say, look, you either wake up or we're not going to send you back to Congress. Sure, Medicaid is great, and Social Security is great, and all of these other entitlements are great, but we aren't going to be around here in 5 or 10 years if you don't balance this budget and balance it right now. And a tax increase, I guarantee you, is not going to balance the budget. They are going to spend 68 cents more than you give them. So in closing, I want to say to you, and that is, don't think that it can't happen here. If Argentina can go from the fifth largest economy in the world to the 78th, because of this kind of deficit problem, we can go from first to 50th just as easily as they did. Now, you hear people jumping on us over becoming a second-rate power, and I'm here talking about a third-rate power in the United States. That's what we're talking about. And I'll guarantee you this, if this hits, and I hope to God I'm wrong and Chuck Bowser is right, but if it hits, your savings, your bonds, your insurance, your pension, you might as well use them for toilet paper because they're not going to be good for anything else. And we know that from what we've seen around the world, it's just as likely to happen here as it's happened to dozens of other countries. So I think when you go to bed at night, you need to kneel down and pray that I'm nuts and that Chuck Bowser is right, and that we get a fiscal panic here in about the next 2 years or so, and we've still got time to fix our economy. And with that happy message, I'm going to close, and I would be glad to take any questions. So thank you very much for the opportunity to talk to you here today. That was about 1990. Now, during the 1990s, we got some control. The Great Recession of 1992-93, which turned President Bush, number one, out and put Bill Clinton in, was replaced by massive amounts of money created by Alan Greenspan to prevent the economy from going upside down. And they began a process under in the Clinton years of using hedonics. That is, we figure the consumer price index not by taking a look at the way prices go up, but we, for instance, they don't count food and they don't count gasoline in the CPI, the consumer price index. They don't count housing prices, they count rents. It's a skewered measure. And they did that with all of the government's measures. They used hedonics, and they do that to this day. Now, the 2005 federal budget deficit was $750 billion, but they reported it at about $350 using hedonics. Now, remember, the magic number was $500 billion a year. So President Bush passed massive tax reductions, and they're financing government through hyperinflation. They're just printing the money and spending it. And the inflation rate is running at about 10.9%. And they're reporting it, the last time I saw it, about 5.2%. So they're lying to us. And the situation is already out of control. The genie is out of the jar. And what the figure report said we needed to do in order to prevent this wasn't done, isn't being done, and isn't going to be done. So as the old saying goes, get the Vaseline out, bend over, grease her up good, because here it comes. And when it comes, everybody denominated in dollars, and everybody that's in debt gets wiped out. And the people that get out of dollar denominations and get into substance, that is property, will then have the property on the other side. Hyperinflation doesn't last forever. Hyperinflation lasts for about 1 year. In the case of Germany, it lasted for 3 years. They hold the champion's role. But in most cases, it'll last a year, in some cases as little as 6 months. The nation of Argentina didn't die. The people of Argentina didn't die, but they lost all of their property. At least most of them did. And here in America, most Americans will lose their property. And over the past 10 years, and especially over the past five, Americans have been encouraged to go out and to refinance their homes, build swimming pools, and buy SUVs. And they did all of the above. They have less equity in their homes. They own absolutely nothing. Everything they have is mortgaged to the hilt, and they're just living by burning the candle at both ends. And it's coming to an end. All of those people will be wiped out, bottom line, wiped out. They will be the cannon fodder. They will be the first people to line up to get the mark of the beast. And then there's a few people out there, people perhaps like you, that can take a look at this and maybe save yourself before the shoe drops. We'll be back again tomorrow talking about hyperinflation. We're about out of time, so let me remind you that you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up, so we got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.